For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to this second special edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host Red Sale, and over the next hour, we'll be looking back at some of the highlights we've recorded during 2021. We'll meet down-at-heel Victorian gumshoe William Arrowwood and his creator Mick Finlay. The blind poet Dave Steele gives us an exclusive preview of his new series of children's stories in verse. We'll hear how 87-year-old Anne Racklin built a home studio to record talking books for the RNIB library during lockdown. And I share an out-of-this-world conversation with astronaut Tim Peake. But first, at the very beginning of the year, I had the great pleasure of reading a terrific time travel story featuring a strong and positive link to sight loss. Space Hopper is Helen Fisher's debut novel and is a wonderfully fresh and entertaining story of faith and love and time travel that blends elements of The Time Traveller's Wife and the TV series Life on Mars. It also features the most plausible blind character I've ever come across in fiction. So how could I not invite Helen onto the show?
Space Hopper is a story about a woman in her mid-30s with two young children. She's happily married. She works at the RNIB and she loves her life. She's got good friends, good job, loves her family. But she carries with her this sadness because her mother died. She lost her mother when she was about 8 years old. And she carries that sadness with her and that grief, but kind of keeps it to herself. And she's got very little to remember her mother by. But she does have a photograph of herself sitting under a Christmas tree in a space hopper box. And she treasures that photograph because she knows that her mum took it. And an amazing sort of series of events leads her to finding herself transported into the past. And she finds herself as an adult under the Christmas tree back in 1977 with her mother asleep upstairs and her younger self asleep upstairs, and she gets the opportunity to spend some time with the mother that she never got to know properly but as an adult. And when she travels back, of course, one of the things that is incredibly difficult is telling anybody what's happened to her, because nobody will believe her and they'll all think she's mad. But she does find a confidant in her friend Louis at work, who also works at the RNIB. So it's really the tale of Faye and her choices and about loss and grief and letting go of the past. That's the basic story.
It's full of questions about faith and trust. Mm-hmm. What we trust in, can we have faith in what our eyes present to us, and can we have faith in the things that we have been brought up to believe or disbelieve? Faye's husband is training to be a vicar and brings that to the fore as well.
Yeah, I think Faye is more scientific. She thinks of herself as more scientific than her husband, and she has real trouble with the fact that he's going into the clergy because he believes in God and he has a very strong faith and she doesn't. But then, of course, what she wants to be able to tell him but feels she can't would require, she believes in the end, the same amount of faith, because it's really what she believes, and having somebody trust in you, believe what you're saying when it sounds crazy. She asks him at one point why he didn't tell her sooner what it was like to be called by God. And he tells her that he always felt that it was a slightly crazy thing to tell somebody because it was a personal thing and it's very hard to believe in something that you can't experience with your senses, which is what Faye has difficulty with. But of course, in the end, her story is just as or more unbelievable than his.
And you take that even further with the character of Louis, who is blind. Yeah. And can't rely on his major sense and has, yeah, to fill in the gaps. He really is the most wonderfully plausible blind character I've ever come across in fiction. I think that's because you don't dress him up as anything different. He is just a character who happens to be blind.
Honestly, I feel so proud, Red, that you've said that. I loved Louis when I was writing him, but I didn't try too hard with him. I had known people who were blind and I sort of pulled on aspects of their characters. But I am immensely proud that you feel that he has been authentically written. And, you know, he's a guy, he has a life, he happens to be blind. It doesn't define him. It can be sentimental to try and portray a blind character as if the blindness doesn't impact their lives as much as it does.
Louis really struck a chord with me. And I'm so glad you didn't take away his rough and irritable edges, because as you know from your own work at RNIB, that's kind of how we are.
Well, exactly. And I think that without even really meaning to at the time of writing, he is pulled from a few of my old colleagues. He's a mixture of a few. And, you know, I think that had I not worked at RNIB, not had any experience with anybody blind or partially sighted, I might have been tempted to try harder to sort of think, what is a blind person like? And of course, you're all as irritable and annoyed and lovely and horrible and as anybody who's got sight. It's crazy to think otherwise. So he was based on a few characters, so he was very easy to write.
As you say, you used to work at RNIB.
I did. I worked at RNIB. Now, I think it was 1999 to 2004. So it was only 5 years. But, you know, I remember them as the best job I ever had. I loved it. There were a lot of redundancies being made when I left and I ended up going traveling. But I've got so many happy memories from there. It was the most interesting work I'd ever done. And I had some brilliant colleagues. I learned a lot. And I miss it, actually. A long time ago now, though.
Were you in product research and development as Faye is in the book?
Yeah, Faye's got the same job as I had. So I was in the research and development department based in London. So the development side was mostly in Peterborough and I was on the research side down in London and I worked as an ergonomist. So yeah, and the experiments, I think we only see one of Faye's experiments where she has Louis wearing rubber gloves and feeling the bust of Mozart or Beethoven and has to describe him. That was an experiment that I had to do. So, you know, I had some interesting work to do there. It was good fun, actually.
You don't sidestep the potential downsides of time travel. Things could perhaps go wrong.
Something I certainly did know when I started writing the book was that I wanted it to be a traumatic journey, something that could threaten her life. And also the fact that the portal itself is a box, a cardboard box, which of course is a vulnerable thing. So she not only has the dilemma of what if she were to get stuck in the past and not get back to the present time, whilst she's also desperate to get back to her mother and spend as much time as she can with her before she loses her. So I wanted her dilemma to be physical as well as emotional.
And it certainly is. That cardboard box takes a bit of a battering. Well, Helen Fisher, once again, congratulations on writing a fantastically entertaining novel with a wonderful blind character.
Oh, thank you so much, Red. I'm really proud of Louis and I'm really glad you enjoyed the book. Thank you so much.
Space Hopper by Helen Fisher is available from the RNIB Library and it's a great read.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB Helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Next up, in this look back at the best of 2021, Sherlock Holmes is probably the world's most famous literary detective, and his character continues to cast a long shadow over crime writers. But it's a challenge that Mick Finlay seems to relish. His Victorian detective, William Arrowood, is the poor man's Sherlock Holmes, and Arrowood makes no secret of his contempt and envy of his more famous rival. With his publication of the fourth book in the series, Arrowood and the Meeting House Murders, I felt it was high time to cross-examine their author.
William Arrowood lives in 1890s London. He's a private detective and he lives on the south of the river. And that's important because there's another more famous detective than him living on the north side of the river, which of course is Sherlock Holmes. So he actually lives in Sherlock Holmes's world, although he never meets him. but he's very, very aware of him. And Sherlock Holmes irritates him intensely because he's much more famous. He earns more money from his cases, and everybody considers him a genius, which William Arrowood doesn't. So Arrowood himself picks up cases from people who really can't afford to pay him very much. Sometimes they can't afford to pay him at all. And he ends up investigating the type of crimes that Sherlock Holmes would not investigate. So these are the sort of grittier crimes in the seedier side of London. So, for example, in the first Arrowood book, they involved Fenian terrorists and what was called the Maiden Tribute, which was the cross-channel trade in young girls, which was a huge scandal at the time. And these are the sorts of cases that Arrowood gets himself involved in, which you don't find featuring in the Sherlock Holmes novels.
And he's a wonderfully Hogarthian character. He's purple in the face and he's got a big overhanging belly. He's quite often drunk. And he lives in poverty in Coin Street in an increasingly overcrowded house. And I really get the sense that you're wanting to reflect just how cheap and precarious life in Victorian London really was.
Yeah, that was really important to me. I was trying to imagine how I would feel if I was suddenly transported into Victorian London and what the sights and smells and sounds would appear to me. And I suppose the first thing I thought of, well, this is a very dirty place. It is overcrowded. Unless, of course, you live in one of the wealthier areas and you have a lot of money. For most Londoners, it was overcrowded, cold, dirty. The food was very often off and or watered down and adulterated. And people who didn't have steady jobs would very much be living a precarious existence and would be scrabbling to find money and often living hand to mouth. And so when I thought of sort of what would be the opposite of a Sherlock Holmes detective, maybe a more realistic detective, I tried to put those characteristics into Arrowood's life.
Yes, I keep finding myself wanting to lead him to a bathhouse and give him a good old wash when I'm reading the books. Now, in this latest book, The Meeting House Murders, you deal with the subject of freak shows in London, and this deals with race and also the excesses of the British Empire.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a huge social and historical issue that I was delving into here, and it actually was quite a difficult book to write as a result, but it's inspired by a true story, which I read in the Illustrated Police News. And this was a case that came to a London magistrate's court in 1879, where five Zulu men appeared in front of the magistrate. And they had been billed to appear as part of a troupe called Farini Zulus, as part of what they called an ethnic exhibition. And freak shows and ethnic exhibitions often happened in the same bill in theatres and so on. But this was a real group of men who were appearing at the London Aquarium, which was this massive glass structure opposite the Houses of Parliament, which is now, I think, where the Methodist Central Hall currently is. And they were appearing in court because they were refusing to perform as Farini Zulus. And then when they got to London, they found that the showman was holding them under guard and refusing to let them leave the house in case people seeing them on the street affected ticket prices. And because I like to have the Arrowood books, each of them to center around a really important social or historical issue, I thought this is an absolutely intriguing world we're opening up here. And also, it shows just one aspect of how British colonialism and the empire returns to London streets. So I decided to use that story as a starting point, but that of course led to a huge amount of research that I had to do. I had to understand the history of Zulus, the history of the British Empire in South Africa. It was really important to me. These are crime novels, so I had to work out a plausible backstory for the group of Zulu men who I invented. I didn't use the same Zulu men. I had to sort of work out, well, what crime could this story be about? And I discovered this incredible bandit gang who operated around Cape Town at that time called the Ninevites. And they were a black resistance to the British authorities, but they were also criminals. And they robbed black people as well as white people. But I decided that the Zulus in my story would be sort of runaways from this gang. So it really opened up a huge area of history. And also, it, of course, it opened up the experiences black men would have faced in Victorian London in the streets, black men with no money particularly. It was a huge challenge to write, but I felt, I mean, particularly given the political climate at the moment, it seemed to be the right story to write right now.
And of course, Arrowood, being at the bottom of white society himself, feels a lot of sympathy with the Zulus. And his deductive methods are based on psychology, on observing people. And in that way, he does have similarities with Sherlock Holmes, but in a way that is more familiar to us rather than the giant leaps of deduction that Holmes makes.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the idea of the character of William Arrowood before I had a story for the first book, and I wanted him to be the anti-Sherlock Holmes. So he had to have some method of solving crimes which didn't rely on examining cigarette ash and the type of clay on a carpet. Because I work in an academic department as a psychologist, I decided I would make him use the psychological theories of the day to try and solve his crimes, which led me to some really fascinating reading about how Victorians understood human psychology, and then trying to get him to apply some of these ideas, many of which were completely wrong. It was just fun, really. But there's some great classic things which he likes to apply. So, for example, there was a book called that Gustave Le Bon wrote about crowds, and it was sort of the first book about crowd psychology. But Le Bon, who was a French aristocrat and very much fearful and suspicious of crowds, particularly crowds of poor people, decided that when crowds assembled, a collective madness ensued. And this was because emotions transmitted through the air from one person to another as if they were infectious diseases. And he believed that emotions were transmitted by some form of magnetism. And so Arrowood is sort of taken up with this idea, and you know, he very much tries to sense out people when he's talking to them, when he's interviewing them, and he tries to pick up on their emotions. And he believes he's picking up by magnetism, but actually he's probably picking it up by all the non-verbal cues that we normally do. But he's very much attuned to this and very much trying to do it. So that's just one example of the Victorian psychology he uses. And he sort of stumbles towards the solutions through these, even though sometimes they're not quite right.
Now, every great detective needs a fantastic sidekick. And we have a man mountain in Norman Barnett, the Bermondsey-born companion through whom we see William Arrowood. Barnett is Arrowood's Watson.
Yeah. I mean, I did model that relationship on Holmes and Watson. But again, if Arrowood has to be different from Sherlock Holmes, then I decided Barnett had to be very different from Watson. The stories are narrated by Barnett, as they are by Watson, but Barnett is from the slums. So he's from a part of Bermondsey, which was notorious slum. He's had a terrible life up until the point that he, well, probably still when he starts working with Arrowood, it's still terrible. But it was pretty awful when he grew up. It was a very brutal neighbourhood. He had to do a lot of things that he deeply regrets in order to survive those years. But he's very sensitive about people being critical of the working classes. So when he goes about his work with Arrowood, when they have to interview people who make derogatory comments about people because they're poor, Barnett really feels that. And he also sees Arrowood's pomposity and sometimes Arrowood's unpleasant attitudes. And sometimes he calls him out on it, but other times he just observes it. But yeah, he is the guy who takes the beatings for Arrowood. He doesn't earn as much money. He's living even more precariously than Arrowood's living. But of course, they are friends, despite the sort of difference in power between them. Just as Holmes and Watson were friends, they do love each other, really. And they'll never really leave each other. And they're stumbling through life from case to case, relying on each other for support.
There is a wonderful sense of irony in these books and the constant threat that Sherlock Holmes might appear around the corner and just sweep past Arrowood and Barnett. I assume that they are equally good fun to write.
I really enjoy writing them. Reading the history is wonderful. I just feel such a privilege that I can do that. I'm not having to read about forensic science. I'm reading about Victorian social history, and that is great. I love that. But I suppose my greatest pleasure is the characters themselves, because now Arrowood is sort of in this extended family because he's got his best friend Lewis, who's a Jewish secondhand arms dealer with one arm. There's his sister Etty, who's a very moral Christian, who he lives with. And now also he lives with his ex-wife, both of whom had babies in the fourth book. There's a street girl from a previous case who's 6 years old, who's moved in with him as well. He's only got one bedroom, of course. So they're all living in this house together. The man with Down syndrome from book two is now living with Lewis, his best friend. And we've got Norman Barnett himself, and his love life is a constant theme throughout the book. So there's this group of people who are moving through all the books, and I just love working on their relationships and having things happen. And they get annoyed with each other, they fall out, they challenge each other morally, but they, of course, all love each other in the end. I love writing the crime aspect of it, but I think I love even more writing the way in which their relationships are changing throughout these books.
All four books in the Arrowood series are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library, thanks to the generosity of publisher HarperCollins.
If you need someone who understands sight loss, we're here for you. Our free and informal Living Well with Sight Loss courses aim to help you increase your independence, boost your confidence, and connect with others to share experiences. Join a course by visiting rnib.org.uk/livingwellwithsightloss or call us on 0303 123 9999.
Welcome back to this Read On retrospective of 2021. Still to come, I discuss alien invasion and the value of space exploration with astronaut Tim Peake. And we'll hear which books inspired the winner of this year's Booker Prize. But before that, October the 7th was National Poetry Day, and Read On celebrated with a world exclusive.
Dave Steele is the blind poet. Through his collections of verse, Stand By Me, RP, he's helped bring solace and understanding about sight loss to thousands of BVI people and their families worldwide. Dave, happy National Poetry Day. And I believe you've got a really exciting announcement about a book in verse.
Yeah, it's been a long time coming, but my first children's book, which is going to be the first of a new series, will be launching this month, and it's available now to pre-order via my website, and it's called Austin's Amazing Adventures.
This series has been inspired by your experiences and your son as well.
Yeah, it's strange the way it kind of came about. It actually started a couple of years ago when I saw an article, I think it was in The Guardian, by the children's author Julia Donaldson, who you may know did The Gruffalo and Stickman and Room on a Broom and lots of amazing children's stories that are all written in that poetic style. And I've been reading these books to my son Austin since he was 2 years old. We do Facebook Live bedtime stories every night, and we'd read these stories because I can memorize these poetic stories, so when I'm unable to see the words in the text that's on the page, I'm able to kind of read them without actually having to read them as such. And Julia Donaldson was talking about how there needs to be more children with disabilities featured in children's stories. And when I read that article, it sparked something in me. And in the first night after reading that article, I wrote the first 6 books of this new children's series. And it's about a young visually impaired boy based on my son, Austin, who is not visually impaired at the moment, but he has a 1 in 2 chance of losing his sight when he's older due to the retinitis pigmentosa that I have. And in the story, he's a young visually impaired boy losing his sight from the age of 5. He has his best friend when he's a little bit older in the story, who's his guide dog. And it's about a young visually impaired boy going to a mainstream school and all the challenges and things that he goes through on a day-to-day basis. And this whole idea is about normalizing low vision and blindness and disability so that other children understand that kids with disabilities and low vision and blindness are just like them. And also those children that are living with these conditions, it gives them a character they can really identify with and relate to.
And the books have been illustrated, and there is also an audiobook version, I believe.
That's correct. In fact, the audiobook version is actually going to be given free as a download with every purchase from my website of the books, so we can make them truly accessible. We hope to have a Braille version in the future as well, very shortly. We're currently working on that at the moment. These books are really about trying to get them in the hands of as many children and schools as possible, because what we've done as well is, at the end of each story, there is what we call a section of open-ended questions, talking points, guided learning. So these are questions about the story that the child has just read, and it encourages children to put themselves in the shoes of Austin in the story and talk about how they would feel in certain situations. And these books actually can be used as part of a lesson within schools as well. So, you know, we're really hoping that a lot of schools will use these as part of the lessons.
For schools and also individuals who are interested in pre-ordering a copy, where do they go?
They can just go to my website, which is theblindpoet.net, and all the information's on there. There's lots of great videos and stuff like that talking about the books. And obviously the website's fully accessible as well to anyone who is unable to read text.
And regular listeners will, of course, know that I never get you onto the show without asking you to read something. So if possible, could we have a sneak preview of Austin's Amazing Adventures, please?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a world exclusive, never been read before anywhere. So it's an absolute pleasure to read the opening of this book just for you guys. So here we go. In a little town not far from here, there's a boy that you might know. His name is Austin Steele and his guide dog friend named Joe. Each day they take adventures as they travel around the world. And here within these pages is how their story first unfurled. When Austin was just 5, his sight began to disappear. But like his dad, he wasn't sad and felt no need to fear. For Austin's dad had shown him that the vision in his mind could overcome the obstacles of slowly going blind. His tunnel view was shrinking, independence getting tough. Some days the outside world felt far too hard, he'd had enough. But with a paw, what once unsure became a strength to grow, returning pride for by his side a friend in guide dog Joe. Now Austin feels amazing, and he knows that he can be absolutely anything, despite what he can't see. For with the little he has left, each day is filled with pride. The busy places once had feared, with Joe no longer shied. Though people stare, they couldn't care, just smile and say hello to Austin Steele and his best friend, his guide dog, who's named Joe.
That's a wonderful and empowering message, and one that people need to learn as early in life as possible. So perfect for school-aged children and their parents.
I mean, that's what it's all about. It really is about helping those kids to be a little bit more understood and break down those kind of barriers. And I really have this idea of, as these stories kind of progress, we're going to have it like any kind of mainstream school, where you'll have different children facing different challenges. We'll tackle things like autism, wheelchair use, and the possibilities with this of really breaking down lots of social barriers for disabilities in general is something really exciting.
Well, Dave Steele, I hope it becomes an instant bestseller and classic.
Thanks, Red. Thanks for having me.
For more information about Dave Steele and his wonderful books, go to theblindpoet.net.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. Now, as all fans of audiobooks know, getting the right narrator is a vital component. And with lockdown meaning that many studios were closed or working at reduced capacity, our wonderful readers had to be even more resourceful than usual.
The last time we met Anne Racklin, she'd just finished recording The Tin Ring, the remarkable story of Zdenka Svetlana, a Holocaust survivor. Anne was inspired to do this for the RNIB Library after a blind volunteer who was helping her during lockdown mentioned how much he wanted to read the book, but that no audio version was available. Anne, who's 87, so enjoyed the process and did such a good job that she immediately offered to record more titles for RNIB. She chose her 10 Famous Children series, which she originally wrote some 20 years ago, and which grew from her long educational career as the founder of Music for Fun. She joined me from her home in East Sussex to tell me more.
My life's work has been with children and music. I've worked a lot in my life on behalf of hearing impaired children, and I thought, no, this is time for me to do something for visually impaired children. And what better than to record my own books?
Tell us about the 10 Famous Children.
Well, a lot of people know about the great composers when they were grown up and what they did. But what about when they were children? And so I wrote 10 books about the childhood years of the 10 great composers, who turned out to be naughty boys, who turned out to be all kinds of lovely, exciting things that children would want to hear and perhaps children would be able to identify with. And in particular, of course, there were people like Beethoven, who had to cope eventually with being deaf, and Handel, who also had very, very serious visual problems. And so they still managed somehow or other to become legends that lasted over the centuries. So their childhood years are revealing and funny, and I think important for children to learn.
The series was originally published in print in the early 1990s, but that's before it was more usual to make audiobook versions.
That's absolutely true. But now, of course, people are very keen on audiobooks. And I was able to actually enhance the books by recording them because I could add my own comments when the book was finished, which I did in each case, very short, but just perhaps a few little words about what did happen when they grew up, and also to add the music, which I found was a very important thing to do. Particularly, let's say, take the example of Mozart, who, of course, composed extraordinary music when he was 5 and 6. And that's the music I've added to the book. And in each case, I've used simple music, mostly piano music, but some orchestral music too. But music that I hope will appeal to children that may not have listened to classical music before. There's ballet music, for example. In the Tchaikovsky story, I've used The Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, which is appealing and part of the story of the Nutcracker. So I've been able, I think, to enhance the books by recording them for the RNIB.
And I believe that the music has a family connection as well.
Well, it does, because my late husband was a wonderful pianist. He started playing the piano when he was 3, gave his first concerts at 4. And when he was only 17, he was chosen by Rachmaninoff to bring his 3rd piano concerto to Europe. He was a brilliant pianist. And it's rather lovely for me to use some of his piano recordings and give them a new life. He would really approve of what I'm doing and be thrilled that it's his performances that the children are going to hear.
And you too have a background in performance as a professional narrator, but I believe you had to build your own home studio, firstly to record The Tin Ring, and now for these books too.
Yes, I am a professional narrator. I performed with symphony orchestras all over the world in concerts and music festivals, and my method is to narrate my stories to the music. But of course, in this particular case, reading the books without the music, that's something I hadn't done before. And because of COVID, there was no way I could go to a recording studio, especially where I live. I did try and find one, but it wasn't going to work. So the only thing to do was to build my own. So I consulted my daughter, who is in Paris, and she told me how to build the studio. She's a broadcaster. She worked for the BBC, and she's still recording stories for Chinese children. She told me, "Mum, it's not difficult. All you have to do is buy some foam and how to build it." And so I built it in the room over my garage, where it's quiet, and except for an occasional aeroplane that likes to do aerobatics out over the top of our cottage, it was pretty quiet. So I was able to record all of the books as I did The Tin Ring, doing it all myself. That was the challenge, really. Not so much building the studio, but using the computer at the same time as recording and all the complicated things one has to do, which normally a sound engineer would do. Then when the books were finally recorded, of course, they went to a sound engineer who's worked with me and with my daughter, and he took out any pops and anything that needed the ambiance improved a little bit. But otherwise, I was my own sound engineer. It's a new profession.
One of those lovely stories with a positive twist that COVID and the lockdown has brought us. And I believe that even before you started reading the books, you needed to transcribe them from paper onto a computer.
Yes, that's absolutely true. That way I didn't have to turn pages and make a noise.
A degree of professionalism that we have come to expect in the R&IB Talking Books studios, but maybe not from somebody who volunteers their own time to record the books for us.
It was a joy to do, and I do hope it will open up a whole new vista for visually impaired children, and perhaps even for teachers in schools, because the stories are intriguing and fun. And I researched that everything in them is true. Beethoven did try to steal eggs from his neighbor's chickens and even caught a cockerel and gave it to his parents to serve up for lunch. There's some marvelous, marvelous little stories that children can identify with. And they're not those stuffy old composers that we used to learn about in school. You know, it was a case of Handel lived in such and such a time and here's his music, now listen. I don't believe in that. I believe in making it fun, making it alive. And that's what I tried to do with the famous children books. They were originally hugely successful. They were translated into 17 languages. And even to this day, they are being issued to Chinese, Korean and Indonesian children.
Well, many thanks for making them fully accessible to children with print disabilities. And I think creating 10 wonderful mini albums that show just what a diverse bunch the famous composers were.
Absolutely. I mean, all grown-ups were once children. And in one particular case, the case of Haydn, a very naughty boy grew up to be extremely famous and to this day a wonderful great composer.
And in the case of Beethoven and Handel, conclusive proof that disability need be no barrier to success.
That was my main thought all the way through, that it doesn't matter what disability you have, there's always something you can do and not things that you can't do. And when you hear about some of the things that these great human beings did, that created such miraculous music that has crossed the centuries in spite of being deaf, in spite of having visual problems. It's really remarkable and it's an inspiration. And that's what I wanted to get across to the children.
George Handel sat down on the stool and gazed at the keys. He was breathless with excitement. Then he began to run his fingers over the keyboard. "Oh, Aunt Anna," said George, "thank you. This is the best birthday present in the whole world." "I knew you would like it," said Aunt Anna. "But remember, George, practice when your father is out. You know he doesn't approve of music."
Anne Rackland's 10 Famous Children series is available now from the R&IB Library, and they're a wonderful listen for children and adults alike.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, featuring the best of 2021 in books. Now, before we hear the books of your life chosen by the winner of this year's prestigious Booker Prize, it's not often in life that you get to meet an astronaut, but back in October, I was able to enjoy an out-of-this-world chat with one-time resident of the International Space Station, Tim Peake.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Tim Peake is the British astronaut who inspired a generation. He's also a best-selling author with 4 books under his belt. And now he's joined forces with another star writer, Steve Cole, to create Swarm Rising, a novel for children in the middle grades, which explores themes close to Tim's heart in a page-turning adventure. Tim joined me from his home in Chichester.
Hello, great to be here.
So, for anyone who hasn't yet picked up Swarm Rising, it's an alien invasion story with a difference.
Yes, it's essentially an action-adventure story. And as you said there, it's about aliens coming to Earth. But it's a lot more than that, because I was thinking, you know, when we travel outside the solar system, how are we really going to do it? You know, are we going to go as flesh and blood, organic form? Can we really travel for thousands of light years to get to other planetary systems? Unlikely. And I'd had inspiration from many other sources and thought, well, the future of humanity is probably that we get upload our brains into some future quantum supercomputer and travel through the solar system, through the universe at the speed of light as a digital intelligence. So what happened if alien civilizations did this millions of years ago and they are traveling currently through the universe? And that's how they arrive on planet Earth, as a digital intelligence. And from there, the action adventure picks up. So it's been a huge amount of fun writing it with Steve Cole, who's a brilliant children's novelist. And we've had a lot of fun bouncing ideas off each other.
The swarm is the hive mind that has been uploaded and has come to Earth really to save us from ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of underlying themes there that hopefully, whilst, you know, young adults are reading it and enjoying the action and the adventure, also getting you thinking a bit about stuff like artificial intelligence, about how we need to be a little bit careful about that and think about what that might mean for humans, and to think about our planet, our environment. You know, why are the swarm here? Well, actually, because Earth is so precious as a cradle of life, one of the places in the universe that life can flourish, and that's what needs to be protected. And the swarm's less interested about humanity, but they are interested about planet Earth.
And you, as you say, you very much use it to explore your love of science, technology and ecology. And in Steve Cole, you seem to have found the ideal partner. He's written over 200 books for children already, and he also worked on Doctor Who.
Yes, I know. I mean, it is so great speaking to him. And you can give an idea to Steve and say, listen, this is the concept I'm thinking about. And then he'll twist it and turn it and create a great narrative around. And we just bounce his ideas off. So it's wonderful to have that relationship and to be able to just explore these concepts with somebody who's got a brilliant mind for thinking outside the box.
I'm Danny Monday, but my story starts on a Tuesday. Hilarious, right? You can imagine the crummy jokes I've had to put up with at school my whole life, like, oh no, I thought it was Friday, but here's Monday, or who puts the week into weekday, Danny Monday, or you're going to marry Freya Knight so you can call yourself Danny Monday Knight, which doesn't even make sense because A, I wouldn't have to take her surname if I didn't want to, and B, Freya Knight can break your bones just by looking at you, so I would not mess. Anyway, back to Monday on that Tuesday. It was just an ordinary night, you know. Mum out at work, homework half finished, Jamila round, being a pain. Nah, that's harsh. She's my best mate. I've known her all my life. We were in my room playing Breakout Saturn on PlayStation, stuffing Doritos and having a laugh. Or we were, until Jamila totally got me killed by giant alien spiders.
Neka Okoye narrating Swarm Rising, written by my guest Tim Peake in collaboration with Steve Cole.
I do remember from reading, I think it was Limitless, that even though you were 400 miles above the Earth in the International Space Station, you never felt so close to Earth as when you were looking down on it. And that's when you realized its fragility.
I think sometimes you have to take that step back in order to see the holistic viewpoint. And when you look at the whole planet from space, and bear in mind that it's not just the view, you've got this kind of serenity of floating in weightlessness, not feeling any forces on your body, no pressure points, just in this free fall around the planet in a perfectly silent, quiet environment, just gracefully gliding over at 25 times the speed of sound. And you kind of think, yeah, you know, I can put that into perspective. I can see now where we are, our position. And I think it just gives you that ability to really think carefully about what it is that Earth's doing for us, that tiny atmosphere protecting all life, and the billions of years it's taken not just to create life, but to create the planet itself.
Something I read recently was that the Apollo astronauts suffered from cataracts because of cosmic rays, which I assume you were probably aware of before you went up into the International Space Station. Were you worried, and what measures were taken to prevent you from losing your sight to cataracts?
Yes, we're obviously aware of the radiation exposure that we're going to get during a mission. And to put that into context, for 6 months in space, it's about the equivalent of 8 chest x-rays every day, somewhere on the region of 150 to 200 millisieverts over our 6 month stay. So it is an increased risk, but the agencies keep us below a 3% greater cancer risk than the average population. But you wouldn't want to be spending more than about 2.5-3 years in space under the current levels of radiation protection we have. The cosmic rays, you see them every time you close your eyes at night before you go to sleep, when you're just waiting to drop off. You see these flashes streak across your eyelids, and that is cosmic rays hitting the back of your retina. So we are aware every single day that we are in a radiation environment. We carry dosimeters with us. And when we came back from space, our eyes are tested before, after, and during, and there is evidence of radiation damage to the retina, small amounts of radiation spots. But again, it's very, very minor, and it's considered a very low risk. Something we've discovered recently, though, is that spaceflight can permanently change your eyesight in some astronauts, and some are more susceptible than others in terms of long-sightedness, so hyperopia. Now, in my case, I've come back from space and I have found myself to need reading glasses. But then again, I'm 49 years old and most people over 40 probably are at that stage wearing reading glasses. So who knows? Maybe that's space. Maybe that's just old age. But we're more interested in the potential for long-term damage through radiation exposure. And what we're doing about that, of course, is improving the radiation shielding on our spacecraft. When we go to Mars, we're going to have much better radiation protection. When we go outside the Earth's magnetosphere, where we get less natural protection from the magnetosphere, we need to strengthen the shielding again on our spacecraft. Currently, our crew habitation quarters, where we sleep, that's where we get the best protection. So if ever there was a solar storm or any increased risk of radiation, we would be instructed to go to our crew quarter.
And when people ask the question, well, is it worth spending all these billions of pounds on going into space? I take it your answer would be, we'll look at the amount of scientific research that we do in places like the International Space Station.
Often my first response is, well, let's look at what that financial figure is, because people say that sometimes, thinking back to the Apollo era and the kind of amounts of money that were spent back then, we're spending nothing like that these days. Our budgets are far, far smaller. In Europe, it costs the European taxpayer about the equivalent of a cinema ticket every year to do all of the research in space. That's not just the human spaceflight element. So in terms of our budgets, they're much more reduced. And what we get in return, of course, is all scientific evidence for the benefit of everybody on Earth. We're looking at sustainable techniques to improve solar efficiency, battery technology, water purification systems. We're looking at reducing the weight and increasing the strength of engine turbine blades and car vehicle engines so we can make them more efficient. We're looking at food production methods. So if we can grow food in space, we can grow food in the Sahara Desert. We're looking at protein crystal growth for drug development for Parkinson's, motor neurone disease, Huntington's disease. It's every day on board the space station. There's just a plethora of science going on that is all for the benefit of people back on Earth. It's not money being spent in space and being lost forever.
And that's something that your mission really brought home to all of us. I think you captured the hearts of an entire generation by your appearances and the hundreds of experiments that you were doing. And I think you interacted with over 2 million children in your 6 months in space.
That's right. I mean, it was quite interesting because when we started down this journey of having a mission, it was so valuable because I sat there with the UK Space Agency and we said, well, we haven't had this opportunity since Helen Sharman flew in 1991. And now it's a completely different era with communication, with social media, with video that we can transmit back down from the space station. We need to really embrace this. And we had this brilliant education program. And we thought, if only half of these programs work, we'll call that success. And of course, we were blown away by how successful it was. And doing the Cosmic Classroom from space with Kevin Fong, for example, there were 500,000 school children tuned in just for that. And it's a lot of fun. But also, I think it showed how much excitement there is about science, space, technology. And I think that young people today really do embrace it, and they realize that technology is going to play such an important part in their future, and that's why they're interested in it.
And that's why it was a logical next step for you to write a book for children, I take it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a bit of a fun project that I wanted to do. It's been burning away, having two young boys of my own and loving reading stories to them and loving what stories that they enjoy. But also, I thought it's a great opportunity to write something that's fun, it's action-packed, it's adventure, but it has some really important underlying messages.
Well, hopefully reading Swarm Rising and the other four books that you have written will help a future generation achieve their dreams. But for the time being, Tim Peake, thank you so much for coming onto the show and discussing your life as an author and an astronaut with the Read On listeners.
Thanks very much, Red. Great talking to you.
Swarm Rising is out now in print, ebook, and audio. And now, to round off this look back at a year when fact sometimes seems stranger than fiction, here's an author who spent a lot of time pondering the human condition. As the year drew to a close, the winner of the UK's most prestigious literary award, the Booker Prize, was announced. And it proved third-time lucky for South African author Damon Galgut. His dark satire, The Promise, explores the toxic legacy of apartheid through a family saga that spans four decades and as many funerals. He joined me from his home in Cape Town to share the books of his life.
Damon, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Well, quite a few books, actually, because when you first discover reading, everything seems magical. And probably the book that hung over my childhood most consistently was the very predictable choice of Lord of the Rings. But that's not the book I'm going to offer up today. In fact, the book that had the biggest effect on my writing life was not a book per se. It was a short story by Roald Dahl, and not one of the children's stories either. We had a very unusual teacher when I was about 12 years old who started reading to us in English class some of Roald Dahl's dark, twisted adult stories. I mean, not the saucy ones, the ones with a nasty twist in the tale. And one of those stories, Pig, had a huge effect on me. I'd recently become vegetarian, and the hero at the center of the story is a small boy about my age then, called Lexington, who has been raised as a vegetarian, and his parents die, and he lands up on a tour going to visit an abattoir in Chicago, and something absolutely unspeakably terrible happens to him there. And although it's probably not fit material for a child, I was absolutely bowled over by this story, because I think I realized that books didn't have to comfort and console you. They could actually shock you and disturb you. And I suddenly realized that this thing I wanted to be doing, writing, was quite a powerful tool, a weapon almost, if you like, to upset people's complacency. So although that teacher got into trouble for reading us those stories, as a writer, I've been forever grateful to him. I still am.
Once upon a time, in the city of New York, a beautiful baby boy was born into this world, and the joyful parents named him Lexington. No sooner had the mother returned home from the hospital, carrying Lexington in her arms, than she said to her husband, "Darling, now you must take me out to a most marvellous restaurant for dinner so that we can celebrate the arrival of our son and heir." Her husband embraced her tenderly, and told her that any woman who could produce such a beautiful child as Lexington deserved to go absolutely anywhere she wanted. But was she strong enough yet, he inquired, to start running around the city late at night? No, she said, she wasn't. But what the hell?
Stephen Thorne narrating Pig from the collected short stories of Roald Dahl, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, you know, that seems to suggest a comfort read, and I'm not big on comfort reading, but the book I would choose is probably Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. It's the sort of book that you need to sit very still for. She's deeply religious. She's a Christian. I personally have no religious sentiments to speak of, but it's a book that you can't lightly dismiss. So the experience of reading it requires you to listen to her in as serious a way as she's speaking to you. So that would be a good book, I think, to pay attention to if you're under a blanket when the rain's coming down outside and contemplating the great meaning of things.
My own dark time, as I call it, the time of my loneliness, was most of my life, as I have said, and I can't make any real account of myself without speaking of it. The time passed so strangely, as if every winter were the same winter and every spring the same spring. And there was baseball. I listened to thousands of baseball games, I suppose. Sometimes I could just make out half a play, and then static, and then a crowd roaring, a flat little sound, almost static itself, like that empty sound in a seashell. It felt good to me to imagine it, like working out some intricate riddle in my mind, planetary motion.
Kim Jerome narrating Gilead by Marilynne Robinson, which is available from the RNIB Library.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, actually. It's a book by a friend of mine, but I'm not punting it because she's my friend. I'm punting it because she's a brilliant writer. And it's a novel that's only just appearing. It's called Burnt Coat. It's by Sarah Hall. Sarah's a really, really fine short story writer, but she's a great novelist as well. And Burnt Coat is sort of somewhere in between. It's more of a novella, I think, than anything. I'm expecting there's going to be a whole new genre, if you like, of COVID literature, literature about lockdown and isolation and about this experience we've all been going through and still are. And Burnt Coat might be at the very, very vanguard of that movement. It's a lockdown novel, but it's not the sort of lockdown novel you would expect. I'm not going to say too much more about it because I hope people will go out and, you know, satisfy their curiosity by reading it themselves. But I think it's a really fine piece of work.
There's no one to inherit, so I've made provision for Burnt Coat to pass over to the heritage. The machinery alone is worth thousands, and the bullfinches are in good condition. They could be used by roofers. Perhaps they will open the workroom again, let people come in and watch. There are keys with the solicitor and I will post a set to Carolina along with the letter of instruction. I'm sure she's imagined the scenario.
Louise Brearley narrating Burnt Coat by Sarah Hall, which is available commercially.
Damon Galgut, thank you so much for being a guest on the show today and sharing your love of reading.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Like all the books on the shortlist, The Promise is available from the RNIB Library thanks to the generous support of the Booker Foundation. And you can hear interviews with all the shortlisted authors by downloading Read On episodes 242 and 243 from your favourite podcast provider. Alas, that's all we've got time for this year, but Read On will be back as usual in 2022. Thanks to all my guests, to my wonderful producer Hannah, and of course to all of you for listening. Enjoy the rest of the Yuletide break, and let's all hope for a happy and healthy new year. Farewell until then, and don't forget to read on!